smile at me, I will understand. 'Cause that is something everybody everywhere does in the same.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was Wooden Ships from Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It's a very beautiful song, a very haunting song. And it's a song about a time the world was on the edge of catastrophe, a time when we literally stood on the edge of nuclear annihilation. And today, we're once again standing face to face with a crisis that could spell the end of the planet, the end of a habitable planet, and possibly the end of humanity. Yet the response to this crisis is so damn far from commensurate with what's needed. Later on in the show, we'll be speaking with Raymond Latta, a communist political economist, about the climate crisis and what it's going to take to solve it. Before that, we'll talk with Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the upcoming transfer of Guantanamo detainees to Thompson Prison in Illinois. And to kick the show off, we're going to talk with Marjorie Cohn, law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. We're going to be talking with Marjorie about an article she recently wrote on the case of Lynn Stewart, one of the most radical lawyers in the country. A recent U.S. Court of Appeals decision ordered Lynn to report to jail to serve out a sentence of more than 2 years. Lynn received this sentence as a result of action she took while defending a client a number of years back. Marjorie calls Lynn Stewart a victim of the war on terror, and we're going to find out why. Marjorie, how are you?
Good. How are you, Michael?
Much better now that I hear your voice.
I was hanging on and didn't even know that you lost me.
Aye. Well, let's get into it. You wrote an article called The Casualty of the War on Terror, The Case of Lynn Stewart, and I was really impressed with that because, as I was saying, I think there was far too little attention, far too little stir and uproar around Lynn Stewart, one of the most radical attorneys in the country, a thoroughgoing people's lawyer being sent to jail. As you say, a casualty of the war on terror. Can you tell people why you called it that?
Well, she was, the Court of Appeal decision said that she was convicted principally with respect to her violation of the special administrative measures. And these were measures that were placed on her client, Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, who is serving a life sentence for terrorism-related crimes. And these SAMs, as they call them, special administrative measures, restrict his ability to communicate with persons outside the prison. So she signed them, and lawyers who violate these SAMs can expect to suffer administrative consequences, such as being denied visiting privileges. But she was indicted on felonies for this, and interestingly, she was indicted after 9/11. Her alleged crimes took place before 9/11, and so it's pretty clear that they wanted to make an example out of her and to chill the willingness of criminal defense attorneys to defend people who are accused of terrorism-related crimes.
Well, let's look at how all that was expressed, you know, how it played out in a special treatment dished out to Lynn. Now, you've spoken a little bit about the severe penalty Lynn faced for the violations of the special administrative measures, and that was more severe than the penalty usually given for violations of these measures. But there were many other examples of the same kind of thing. For instance, the different approach of the trial judge and the appeals court towards her sentence.
Yes. Well, the trial judge, who was there and presided over the 9-month trial, sentenced her after she was convicted of felonies, including conspiracy to conceal a conspiracy, which may have constitutional problems in and of itself. It's conspiracy to commit a conspiracy, neither of which were ever completed. She never harmed anyone as a result of her actions. But he listened to the entire trial, and he, even though the maximum sentence for her convictions under the sentencing guidelines is 30 years. He sentenced her to 28 months. And the Supreme Court held in 2005 that these sentencing guidelines are advisory. They're not mandatory. But the judge, his name is Kotel, he concluded that the terrorism enhancement that she was convicted of would result in an unreasonable result. He said she had no criminal history. He viewed her personal characteristics as extraordinary. He described Lynn Stewart as a dedicated public servant who had throughout her career represented the poor, the disadvantaged, and the unpopular, often as a court-appointed attorney, thereby providing a service not only to her clients but to the nation. He also considered that she suffered from cancer, and there was a significant chance of recurrence. She was 67 at the time of sentencing. She's now 70 years old. So he sentenced her to 28 months, but the Second Circuit Court of Appeals panel, a three-judge panel, second-guessed the judge, who was on the ground, saw the evidence, and is closest to the case, and directed the judge, the trial judge, to resentence her and consider whether she had committed perjury. Well, he actually did consider that and rejected that as a factor. And, in fact, Michael Tiger, who was Lynn Stewart's trial counsel, I interviewed him after the Second Circuit opinion, and he told me that he is convinced that there's ample independent corroboration for Lynn's version of events. So the judge, who was on the ground, came up with this 28-month sentence, and yet the three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals said, take another look at it. Although there were two separate opinions in the Court of Appeals decision, Judge Calabresi, although he agreed with the majority of the three-judge panel that the judge should look and possibly resentence her, he described the trial judge as having extraordinary ability, a well-earned reputation for exceptional judgment. And Calabresi raised two important points in his decision. First of all, he said that it was not irrelevant that Lynn Stewart was the only lawyer criminally charged, even though the Sheikh's two other lawyers also violated these special administrative measures. And he talked about the vagaries of prosecutorial discretion. And then Calabresi and even the majority thought that it was significant that all of the attacks for which Lynn Stewart was convicted occurred before the 9/11 attacks. And Calabresi thought that the judges should take judicial notice, that means take legal note of a certain fact, take judicial notice of the timing of these convictions and, quote, recognize that our attitudes about her conduct have inevitably been influenced by the tragedy of that day. We must be careful then in judging Stewart based on lessons that we learned only after her very serious crimes were committed. And she was indicted in 2002 and convicted in 2005. So I think that it's very important that to note that they're trying, the government's making an example of her, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, in addition to directing the judge to reconsider his sentence, also directed the judge to immediately send her into custody. So this 70-year-old woman with serious health problems, recovering from cancer, she needs surgery, bladder surgery, she suffers from high blood pressure, is now in prison. And the conversations that the conviction were based on, or the case was based on, were the same day that Bush signed the USA Patriot Act into law. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced an amendment to the Bureau of Prisons regulation, which took place 5 days later without any public comment period. And that allowed the government unreviewable discretion to eavesdrop on confidential attorney-client conversations of people in custody with no judicial oversight and no meaningful standards. And they were eavesdropping on conversations, which they never should have been eavesdropping on. But the point is that if she violated these special administrative measures, she should have had her visiting privileges taken away and other things that lawyers have resulted in the past, but not be charged with felonies. And they dragged Osama bin Laden through the trial, even though he had no relationship whatsoever to the substance of any of the charges. And it was clearly an attempt on the government's part to appeal to people's emotions after 9/11 and to make an example out of her so that other criminal defense attorneys would be less willing to defend some of these terrorism prosecutions.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today to Marjorie Cohen, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and law professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. We're talking with Marjorie about Lynn Stewart, the case of Lynn Stewart, who was recently ordered to jail to serve out a 28-month sentence for action she took defending her client. Marjorie says that Lynn is a victim of the war on terror. In addition to everything you were saying, in terms of actually getting a sense early on of what this was about, you remember Ashcroft going on to David Letterman to announce the indictment of Lynn Stewart?
Yes.
I mean, the fact that all the stuff that you're bringing out, I think, is stuff that people have sort of, oh, we're beyond that to a certain extent, not seeing that this is a continuing process here. And I think that what the point you're just making is the chilling impact of this on lawyers who are, for instance, there's all these Guantanamo things that are going to be coming up. There's all this other stuff that's happening. There's all kinds of things where lawyers like yourself, like Lynn Stewart, need to be out there standing with people on the front lines of the resistance against all this stuff and fighting for people to be able to stay free, stay out of jail.
Yes, Michael, and I would just like to say that the National Lawyers Guild, and Lynn Stewart is a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. National Lawyers Guild lawyers and law students and legal workers have been struggling and continue to struggle since 1937 on the front lines with people who are charged, who are unjustly charged, people who are victims of government overreaching. And I'm very proud to be a member, an active member, and the past president of the National Lawyers Guild. I also want to say that there's a status conference in terms of bringing people up to date on Lynn Stewart's case. Wednesday, December 2nd, there was a status conference to discuss the procedures about Lynn's resentencing, and the question raised by the trial judge was whether he should resentence her from scratch and throw out all of his prior reasoning that went into his previous sentence of 28 months, or whether he should simply clarify and update the sentence that he already gave her, and I don't believe that question has been resolved. But he set up a briefing schedule, and her formal sentencing is now set for April 22nd at 4:30 p.m., and that's in New York. And if people want to write letters in support of Lynn Stewart, there is information on the website, which is Lynn Stewart. I believe it's lynnstewart.org. And they need to be sent to her lawyers to be forwarded to the judge. Yeah, lynnstewart.org, lynnestewart.org.
All right, Marjorie, thank you very much for filling us in on this and all eyes on what happens in New York in April. And we'll have you back to discuss the case more as things develop. So thank you very
much.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Marjorie Cohn, law professor and outgoing president of the National Lawyers Guild, on the persecution and jailing of radical attorney Lynn Stewart for actions she took representing a client. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And that is Chris Washburn and the Scioto's Band from the Land of Nod. It's a piece called Guantanamo. On December 15th, the Obama administration announced that the U.S. government was going to buy the Thompson Prison in Illinois and that they planned to transfer the detainees from Guantanamo, the hostages held by the U.S. in Guantanamo, detainees who, for the most part, have not been charged with anything and who are held in the most inhumane conditions imaginable for many years now. They're going to be transferring them from the prison in Guantanamo to the Thompson Prison in Illinois and calling it change. And right after that, the Center for Constitutional Rights issued a statement that basically said that moving Guantanamo to the U.S., to Illinois, doesn't solve the problem. And here to talk with us about the Center for Constitutional Rights analysis of that decision is Wells Dixon. Wells, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Sure. So what is it? When you guys said that moving the Guantanamo system onshore is not change, what are you talking about there?
Well, what President Obama needs to do is to dismantle not only the prison at Guantanamo Bay, but he has to dismantle the entire Guantanamo Bay regime. That is a regime of indefinite detention. So if he simply moves detainees to the Thompson Correctional Center in Illinois, that's not by itself going to resolve the fundamental problem, which is that he is detaining people indefinitely without charge and without trial. That commitment to restore the rule of law and to end torture and to end indefinite detention is something that President Obama campaigned for, and it's something that we frankly expect him to honor. It's a commitment that he has to honor.
Well, you know, I'm going to talk to you in a couple of weeks and say, how's that going, Wells? Because, you know, I mean, you look at it, and even here, you think about this. Moving the Guantanamo system on shore. Think about this. Here they have 116 of the 210 people who remain at Guantanamo have been cleared for release, but many of them have no place to go. So many of those people or there's a good probability that they're going to end up going to this Thompson prison. And even that, there has to be all kinds of law twisting, law bending, changes, amendments made, because as I understand it, legally, they're not allowed to bring people to the U.S. unless they're bringing them for prosecution.
Well, it remains to be seen exactly what the president's going to do in terms of moving detainees to Illinois. If he does move the 100 or so that are approved for transfer, I think we'll have real problems. He will have real problems, because that's something that holding people indefinitely and holding them without charge, particularly after they've been approved for release, something that, frankly, we would have expected from the Bush administration. And if President Obama is going to continue that policy, then the Guantanamo Bay regime will become part of his legacy as well. And I think he has to make a decision. You know, he cannot pay lip service to our values. He cannot pay lip service to the rule of law. He has to take actual concrete steps to close the prison and to end the regime. So we will be watching very closely over the next weeks and months to see exactly what it is that he decides to do. And if he does try to move detainees to Illinois and to hold them indefinitely without charge, then we will certainly challenge that in the courts and in the court of public opinion.
Just so people get a sense, this Thompson prison is not like Mayberry prison. This isn't Barney Fife guarding a couple of cells and Otis the town drunk in there, and they're just going to pile the detainees in. Can you tell people a little bit about the nature of this Thompson prison?
It is a maximum security prison that is, as I understand it, largely empty at this point. It is a state facility. It's going to be sold to federal government, and the administration has said that they are going to upgrade and retrofit the prison to make it beyond supermax. That's the term they use, beyond supermax. So if you think about that, what that means, you're talking about moving detainees into a facility that is beyond supermax, even though many of them have been cleared for release. Many of them have won their legal cases, and they're still going to be held there. I mean, that's extremely troubling. You know, again, the issue for us is not so much the facility, though, as it is about the regime. I mean, it's really a regime of indefinite detention. And whether you hold someone in a beyond supermax prison or whether you hold them in a five-star hotel, if you hold them indefinitely, you don't let them leave, it's still detention, and it's still prison, and it's still unlawful.
Very important point, Wells. Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're talking with Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Obama administration's plan to transfer the Guantanamo detainees to Thompson Prison in Illinois. Now, Wells, if you put this last point in conjunction with the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that refused to hold Cheney, Bush, or any other top member of the Bush administration, and in fact, any member of the ruling class overall, responsible for, accountable for, the torture that has happened at Guantanamo and continues to happen, what do you think this says about where things are going?
Well, that's absolutely right. As I said before, President Obama campaigned on restoring the rule of law, on ending torture, on holding people accountable for illegality in the past. And, you know, at this point, he is not a new president anymore, and he is not entitled to the benefit of the doubt in terms of how he's going to approach these issues. It's very clear how he is approaching these issues. And as our colleagues at the ACLU like to say, you know, President Bush paved the way for torture. It certainly appears that President Obama is paving the way for impunity. He has shown no desire to hold anyone accountable for what's happened in the past. And he's shown very little desire to affect real and meaningful change for the men who continue to be detained in Guantanamo without charges.
You know, one thing was when I was talking earlier about the nature of the prison itself, that it wasn't the Mayberry prison, I really agree with your point that it's not so much whether you're in a hotel or you're in a supermax prison, you're still under indefinite detention. I think really that's the most important point, and that's something we have to keep utmost in mind. But there is a point that these supermax prisons, for instance, from the reading I've done on them and the people I've interviewed who were, you know, came out of them, the very few people who come out of them, they in and of themselves are, seems to me, even ratcheted up from the conditions that people have at Guantanamo in terms of the ways that people are treated in those supermax prisons. They are literally caged animals under the most inhuman conditions. And that's where these detainees are going from, is the inhuman conditions at Guantanamo to what could be even worse in the middle of Illinois.
Well, that's a very important issue, and it's one of the issues that we're going to watch very closely. If you hold someone in solitary confinement 22 or 23 hours a day, that is torture, and that is illegal. the reality of the Guantanamo prison is that conditions have improved somewhat, which is a positive development, but it, again, doesn't solve the underlying problem of holding people without charge or trial. So if the detainees go from modestly improved conditions in Guantanamo to beyond supermax conditions in Illinois, and that happens sort of reflexively, then that'll be a serious problem. And again, this will become part of President Obama's legacy. He will own this as part of his legacy, which I think would be unfortunate. I don't think that that's something that he would want. It's certainly not something that we would want for him.
Well, let me ask you this as a closing question here, because we keep hitting on the point about indefinite detention. And what do you think in terms of the precedence, in terms of the significance of what you have here now with this move, is you actually have something that sort of incorporates indefinite detention as part of the mainstream in U.S. society. You know, you're bringing these guys, these detainees, many of whom have been jacked up and kept there for no reason at all from the beginning, and you're keeping them there, and you're bringing this whole thing of indefinite detention. What do you think that that says in terms of the importance of this, in terms of precedent, and in terms of what you see as developing on the horizon?
Well, I think if you look at the statistics, if you look at the numbers of detainees who have challenged their detentions and have received decisions from the federal courts, you'll see that of 41 people who have taken their case to a final hearing, 32 of those detainees have won. So you're talking about a success rate for the detainees of about 80%, which is historically consistent with habeas corpus, you know, going back to the 13th century. Roughly 80% of these people are going to win their cases. So you're talking about a large number of detainees who statistically are likely to win their cases who are going to be warehoused in Illinois, in all likelihood. And that is a fundamental departure from the rule of law. It is fundamentally inconsistent with American values, and frankly, I think it threatens the security of this country. You know, people within the United States may look at this and they may say, this is fine. You know, it may be a matter of political fear-mongering, but they may be willing to accept it. But you know what? The rest of the world doesn't accept it. And they look at the United States, and frankly, it degrades and demeans the country for us to continue to hold people indefinitely. I frankly don't know or understand how President Obama can accept the Nobel Peace Prize and turn around several weeks later and set up a new regime to hold people indefinitely without charge on U.S. soil. I just don't see how he can do that legitimately.
Well, Wells, you listen to his speech. I mean, who would have thought you could have gotten anything more Orwellian? War is peace. Here you have a guy that right after he's escalated the war in Afghanistan goes to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. This world is absolutely insane and crying out for radical change. And one of the things I think, just in response to what you were just saying about this, I really feel you on what you're saying around this. I also think that in this country, the people here cannot continue to look at things so much as even, what does it do to us? What does it say to us? What we need to do is stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about humanity. If we don't do that, then we deserve what the people of the world are thinking of us. Because if we sit here and we allow this kind of rape of humanity, constant, ferocious rape of humanity to go on and sit here muzzled and just sit on our hands and pretend that it's not going on, that to me is unacceptable. Wells, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Obama administration's plan to move the Guantanamo detainees from Guantanamo to Thompson Prison in Illinois and then call it change. I want people to know that the Center for Constitutional Rights is one organization that has led the legal battle around Guantanamo and the detainees for 7 years now. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Raymond Latta, communist political economist, about the climate catastrophe, the Copenhagen Conference, and why only a revolution will solve this crisis. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and this is The Michael Slate Show. And that was Sonny Rollins, and it was a piece called Ecocide Blues from an album called Global Warming. Really beautiful album, beautiful piece. You know, people everywhere, all over the world, our attention has been focused on Copenhagen. And, you know, you can't help but thinking, I couldn't help but thinking as I read the news every day, listen to the news, this whole point of the world is really literally hurtling towards what can only be described as an environmental catastrophe. And a whole lot of us are at least somewhat familiar with the most pronounced signs of this, you know, and things like Inconvenient Truth. These kinds of things brought this to our attention. And when we dig deeper into the depth and breadth of this, a lot of us are just literally stunned. And it really comes to the point, if things aren't done soon, really soon, and dramatic things done, we are actually talking about a planet that may be incapable of continuing to be able to support the life that we now find on it. And again, this is catastrophe. And this is the context in which the Copenhagen conference opened up. And it's the context in which the very important resistance and protests at the conference have unfolded. And joining us to talk about all this is Raymond Lotta. Raymond's a revolutionary communist intellectual, a political economist who bases his work on the foundation of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis. And he's done a lot of concentrated work in getting to the truth of what happened in the experience of socialist countries, Soviet Union and China. But he's also done a tremendous amount of work in general on the global economic crisis. And most recently, Raymond presented a webcast titled "The Elephant in the Room, Can Anything Short of Revolution Solve the Environmental Crisis?" Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, Michael, thanks for having me on.
Explain the title of your talk, "The Elephant in the Room."
Yeah, "The Elephant in the Room, Can Anything Short of Revolution Address the Environmental Crisis?" You know, this has been the theme that I've been taking out because, I mean, as you laid out in your opening remarks, I mean, we are, the planet is reaching what's called a tipping point. That is, you know, where the multiple effects, the feedback, the loops caused by global warming are now threatening the very sustainability of life on this planet. And, you know, humanity needs to act. But what stands between what needs to be done, and, you know, very central to that, is completely and radically, you know, radically and decisively phasing out reliance on fossil fuel energies. But what stands between the kinds of measures that need to be taken in terms of changing the energy grid, in terms of protecting species, in terms of overhauling industrial practices, the entire way in which humanity is producing goods and feeding itself, I mean, something utterly radical is required, and that's not going to happen because of the system that we live under. It would be nice if we were all sitting in the room and kind of could look each other in the eye and say, look, here's the problem, and let's mobilize all the scientific know-how, all the creativity, all the determination, all the knowledge that people at the grassroots and in the communities around the world have, and let's solve it. But that's not the nature of the world we live in. It's a world that's dominated by capitalism, that's divided into rich, powerful capitalist countries and the oppressed nations of the third world. And we have this situation now where we're reaching this moment of reckoning, and yet you see what's going on as Copenhagen as a concentrated expression of, you know, of the phenomenon where this crisis is reaching the levels that it's reaching. And really what's required, what the scientists are saying and the consensus is that global carbon dioxide and other greenhouse emissions have to be cut by 25% to 40% in the next 20 years and by 80% by the year 2050. If that doesn't happen, then we could experience the planet a potentially catastrophic sort of effect, multiplier effect of this whole thing. And yet there they are at Copenhagen. I said Stockholm because Obama was coming from Oslo. I was thinking of Scandinavia, from Oslo, where he gave his acceptance, war is peace acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize. And now the great powers are meeting in Copenhagen, and what's going on there is not really about averting climate change. It's about something else. So this is what I'm trying to put on the table. We need to confront the seriousness of this problem. We need to understand what's at the bottom of it, which is the nature of capitalism, you know, what has happened in the world since the Industrial Revolution, the expansion and spread of capitalism, and we need to change the whole system, a system that's based on profit and on just uncontrolled expansion.
Well, let me ask you this, Raymond, because in your speech, and I did have a chance to catch the speech, and it's really remarkable, and I would really highly recommend it to everyone, and they should, if you want to catch the speech, Google Revolution Books New York City, and there's on the front page of that site, there's a link to get to the speech. But if you think about it, in that speech, you made the comment that capitalism is incompatible with a habitable planet. Can you talk about that? That there has to be one or the other going on. Either you have capitalism or you have a habitable planet.
Yeah, right. I mean, I said that green capitalism is a contradiction in terms. You can't have green and you can't have capitalism. And look, there are two levels to this. One, let's look at the state of the world and the whole structure of capitalism, and then let's go below that and see what the dynamics of capitalism are. The United States is responsible historically for the great bulk of the carbon emissions in the world, that is the cumulative emissions. The United States represents 5% of the population, but 30% of the total greenhouse emissions in the atmosphere. So it is historically the greatest source of the accumulation of this, of these greenhouse gases. And we look at the structure of capitalism today. I gave the statistic that of the 10 largest non-financial companies in 2007, six of those companies were oil companies, and three of those companies were automobile companies. So the reliance on fossil fuel is embedded in the structure of industrial and financial capital in the world. And I also point out that this whole system of international production and exploitation that the U.S. dominates as its empire, that within it, it requires military power. And one of the most inconvenient truths that is not addressed in Al Gore's book, it's certainly not a matter of the deliberations in Copenhagen, is, and I think your listeners would be interested, but not surprised to learn that the single largest consumer of oil in the United States is, guess what, the U.S. military. And the single largest purchaser of oil in the world, the entity which purchases more oil than any other single entity in the world, is the U.S. military. So you look at that kind of structure, how the whole economy is based on this, how the whole extension of U.S. military power is literally fueled by that. And then a third level is that right now, and this is sort of part of the sideshow and the shadow play at Copenhagen, contrary to all of these wonderful and beatific pronouncements that we're entering into an age of renewables and it's only a matter of time before capitalism finds its way to this, that actually we're entering a very dangerous period in which the great powers and the capitalist combines and conglomerates and investment sort of concentrations of capital, that actually the whole direction of things is towards more reliance on more difficult to access, more difficult to obtain non-renewable energies. I'm talking about deeper drilling in the Gulf. I'm talking about offshore drilling off the South Atlantic. I'm talking about investments by U.S. oil companies and by other imperialist powers, including increasingly the rising capitalist power of China, investments in West Africa. Even the Arctic, as it melts, is becoming the site of intense geoeconomic competition between the great capitalist powers, overtaking advantage of that to seek non-renewable fuel exploitation there. So you have those different levels of these things that are going on. And then what I do in my talk is I explain what it is about capitalism having that reliance on fossil fuel. This is how it's evolved. This has been its historical evolution. That was accessible, and a certain path of development, what I call path dependency, was set in motion that turned on the profitable exploitation of these non-renewables. But then what underlies that is some very basic features of capitalism that prevents it from dealing with the environment in any kind of rational, sustainable way.
Let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. We're talking with Raymond Latta about how capitalism is destroying the climate and the planet, and why there is no solution except getting rid of capitalism.
You know, Raymond, one thing, it's really interesting to me because on the one hand, you talk about the very operation, the nature and working of capitalism that prevents it from dealing with this. At the same time, there's a point, and I think, I don't know, and when I opened the show up, I played Wooden Ships because it reminded me of the situation we're in today and the situation that we were talking about back then, the whole danger of nuclear war wiping out humanity, wiping out the planet. And I'm wondering in relation to that, there proved to be a point where they were the drive towards war, the intervention of the Soviet Union collapsing actually had a lot to do with that drive towards war being mitigated. But then there's this whole point about there were some things that short of nuclear war, or there was some ability of capitalism to say, look at it and say, okay, maybe this might not be the best thing. Is it not possible? I know, and you mentioned this, you said, look, there's all this research, there's all this willingness of people to do things, there's the technology, there's all these resources, including human knowledge and spirit to do it, but capitalism won't do it. Is there anything to the fact that just in terms of self-preservation, they might look and say, we've got to make some drastic changes, or we've got to make some sizable or significant changes. Otherwise, yes, we have to pay attention to science, and it's going to just, you know, the planet will disappear.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that has to be answered on several levels. mean, first, let's get back to your earlier question about what it is about capitalism that creates this situation that we're confronting. Now, on the one hand, I talked about the historical evolution of modern capitalism since the Industrial Revolution, and I talked about where things are headed now. But there is something about the dynamics of capitalism. I mean, it is a system that's based on profit and on the need to constantly expand, because the competitive struggle, the struggle for market share, whether we're talking about Toyota versus General Motors, whether we're talking about the big energy companies seeking to stabilize and extend their market shares, that the whole nature of capitalism is based on just constant growth and expansion. Because if one capital, and we're talking about huge conglomerations, if one capital, like a Toyota, if it's not expanding and seeking new market share and extending production and new technologies to cheapen cost, if it doesn't do that, then some other capital is going to step in. And countries, whole nation states, are part of this whole dynamic of seeking the means and creating the most favorable conditions economically and socially to continue this whole process of expansion. So this process of expansion based on the search for profit and more profit just leads to this whole phenomenon of reckless and uncontrolled development. And environmental costs are part of the sort of an overhead that they want to limit and restrict to the greatest degree possible. So you have like a Chevron, which has now rebranded itself as a environmentally sensitive company, but they produced, you know, an incredible toxic crisis in the Ecuadorian rainforest because they're expanding, seeking cheap sources of raw materials, in this case, you know, the oil. And then you have the constant expansion of capitalism into different regions of the world. And you take China. This gets back to your point about the end of the so-called Cold War. Well, one of the things that happened with the end of the Cold War is you had this whole new wave of capitalist expansion into the Third World, especially into China, which became sort of the workshop sweatshop for world capitalism. So what happens now is that China is pointed to by many of the great powers, the United States in particular, Obama and Clinton pointing their finger at China. But it's very important to understand that China is the largest recipient of overseas investment in the Third World, that one-third, listen to this, one-third of China's global carbon emissions, its emissions of carbon and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, one-third of those emissions are accounted for by export-oriented plants that are serving the needs of world capitalism. So here's an example of the spread of capitalism, the expansion of capitalism, and then you have this growing pollution that's emanating from these new centers of manufacturing and the advanced capitalist countries, which continue to expand, but they can offload their production and their pollution-generating industries to these parts of the world. So this is the example of sort of the expansion that's just built in. It has to grow, and then, of course, it enters into crisis, as we've seen, but it's seeking new ways to grow. And then the environment is just considered to be an additional cost or burden that each capitalist country seeks to sort of throw onto some other, because it, from their standpoint, is a cost. So this is the kind of functioning of capitalism that we're dealing with, so that China has now created a situation based on these inflows of foreign capital, based on the overthrow of genuine socialism in 1976. China's not a socialist country today, so that 7 of the 10 most polluted cities in the world are in China. So you have this dynamic of capitalism, you have this anarchic quality of capitalism that every capital is looking to maximize gain, that they don't have long-term horizons, 10, 20, 30 years down the way. They're looking for advantage, and they're looking to jockey for position vis-a-vis others. And this is the kind of situation. And one of the things I point out in my talk, and I've been writing about this, is that when you have private ownership, what happens is that rather than looking at society as a whole, the environment as a whole, each capital is calculating and doing its bookkeeping, if you will, from the standpoint of its sphere of cost and calculation. This is what we own. This is what we're marketing. This is what they seek to minimize in terms of their outlays and their investments. And anything outside their sphere of ownership and calculation is not of their concern. That is, it's an external factor, and they pollute the atmosphere. Well, that's not their sphere of ownership. But now we get to your question about, well, why can't they turn this to good account and save save the atmosphere, save the world from the standpoint of their very survival. And I think this is a big question that people have been posing, looking at the deliberations in Copenhagen, and maybe I could speak a little more to that if you want.
I think actually what we need to do is maybe very briefly, if you could, but then I want to move into solutions. And so if you could speak very briefly to that point, and then I have a question to pose to you about solutions.
Well, look, I think what's happening in Copenhagen right now is that there's great deal of sort of bickering and jockeying, as I said, among the great powers. And there was an environmentalist who made a, you know, sort of made a statement the other day, and he said, look, that really what's being struggled out now is the right to the sky. In other words, who's going to own what portions of the sky? How much pollutants can they throw into the sky? And that's a lot of what these deliberations are actually about. And it's not about any kind of radical overhaul of industrial and agro-business practices, anything like that, because so much is invested in all of that now, and they're not going to turn away from that. On the other hand, as you said, they face environmental difficulties and threats, and they are seeking to adjust, but to adjust within the framework of great power rivalry for control of resources. They're trying to make some adjustments within the framework of the leading role of these energy corporations and the whole fossil fuel-based structure of their economies. And they're trying to make some adjustments from the standpoint of how they can introduce new technologies and create new markets, but at the same time exert their financial and corporate control over this. So that one of the most obscene things that's coming out of these deliberations is these new markets for the right to pollute, these what they call the cap and trade, which are pollution permits, which can be bought and sold. And here you see capitalism working to create a new and exotic market for the right to pollute. That's how capitalism functions. So even as they toy with new technologies, they're looking for markets, for profit, and they're not moving in any serious way to overhaul the whole structure and practices of production. So that's sort of my short answer to that. It's not moving in that direction, and they're seeking market solutions which are, A, wholly inadequate to the scope and scale and the urgency of the problem, and B, are going to actually lead to new forms of environmental distress.
Okay, let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Reman Latta about the world climate crisis, the environmental crisis, the march towards, it seems, the hurtling towards climate catastrophe. And what's the cause, and now what's the solution? Now, Reman, one of the things that you talk about in your speech is the problem, you talk about, okay, the conference, that conference never had on the agenda really solving this. And in fact, even if it did, it couldn't do it. But you also talk about another thing, which is the problem of lowered sights and the possibility of change. And talk about, in particular, I was thinking about this, in particular, there's a question that comes up of people always looking at, well, if it's not relying on the influencing or pressuring the various governments and the capitalists and corporations and whatnot to do good in the world, if it's not that, then it comes down to, the other alternative comes down to these kind of do-it-yourself community-based gardens and green living and all this stuff. And yet you pose that revolution is the only way that this can be resolved, and that it can be resolved, it can be solved, but it requires a drastic reordering of the world. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, can I speak to that? You know, this is really, you know, sort of the big question, and that's the elephant in the room. Of course, someone asked me, by elephant in the room, do you mean that the elephants are being threatened? And I was doing some research, and yes, there are environmental dangers to the elephants in the world, but the elephant in the room is that we need a radical, a total, a fundamental change in how society is structured, a whole different economy that operates according to different principles and different criteria, totally opposite to what I was describing about capitalism. So we really have to sort of address the problem from the standpoint of how serious it is, how urgent it is, and what it's going to take to solve it. If it were just a quick technological fix, well, that would be wonderful, but that's not the case. Because, A, even though there's a great deal of technological potential, we need to shift the structure of production and consumption and recognize, you know, that a whole new way of living and relating to each other is necessitated, both by this crisis and by the suffering and the oppression and the injustice that this whole system rains on people. And it is a statement about this system that there is this rather wide and growing gulf between what science is revealing about what's called for and what is actually happening, what's what measures are being taken. And because the crisis is so serious, some people do say, look, anything is better than nothing, but that's not the case. What happens at Copenhagen is going to lock people into locked countries and locked, you know, through various agreements and treaties. It's going to legitimize these carbon markets, these kinds of things. So we need to think big, not because we just want to think big, but because that's what's required to deal with the enormity of this problem. That's what revolution is all about. We have to build a new kind of economy in which production is consciously regulated, in which the protection of the environment is a central priority of development. We cannot have a system based on profit and this to sort of expand growth for the sake of growth. We need to have a system that has a whole different mode of calculation. As I said, capitalism is just seeking to minimize cost, to expand profit, but we need to have a socialist economy, a socialist system that takes all of these factors of human need, of health, the environment, balances between town and country, all of these things into account. And we need a system and a society that really, and this is what's key, unleashes all that creativity and the determination of millions of people. I'm talking about scientists, professionals, meteorologists. These people are held in check now under this system. You know, they have to work for a corporation. They have to sort of make their research acceptable to the government in terms of military support from the U.S. Department of Defense. We have to sort of free science of all of these constraints. We have to free it from the constraint of intellectual property rights so that knowledge is shared. We need to put all this before humanity and solve it through our collective and determined efforts in creativity. That's why we need a revolution in every sphere of society, the economy, in politics, in how science is conducted. These are the big requirements to deal with the big challenges that we face. And that's going to take, as I said, a socialist revolution, which is the stepping stone towards creating a world, you know, that's no longer divided into antagonistic classes, a world in which people can consciously and voluntarily change the world and change themselves.
Now, Raymond, we have just under 2 minutes, and I know this is going to be a press for you, and I'll ask a question real quick. One of the things about socialism, I think, is in addition to everything you're saying, but the unleashing of the human spirit, the human potential to really interact on an honest and real basis with nature seems to be one of the things that would really be at the root of solving these kinds of questions. What would you say about that?
Look, I think it's really true. I just want to quickly, I know we have, there were great breakthroughs in socialist revolutions in the Soviet Union when it was a socialist country in 1917 to 1976 in China. 1949 to 76, there were important breakthroughs in developing a planned economy that really based itself on initiative and mass involvement and participation. But you know what? The ball game has changed. The environmental crisis has gotten so much worse, so we have to look at socialist economies and socialist societies in light of the seriousness of that. And we as communists, speaking for myself, have gained a much deeper understanding of how pivotal this is, and part of that includes not just making environmental sustainability a key link in how socialist society is going to sort of plan and undertake economic and social development, but also the point that you're raising, we have to have a whole new appreciation of the importance of nature, of its the value of biodiversity, and the need for human beings to take responsibility for future generations and what the world will look like when they inherit it. And through this, we have to gain a much deeper appreciation of what nature represents, that we are part of it, and yet we have a special relationship to it because, A, of the negative side, all the damage that has been done, but the positive side, that is our capability to actually preserve the planet.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much for joining us today. And I did have a chance to catch the speech, and it's really remarkable, and I would really highly recommend it to everyone. And they should, if you want to catch the speech, Google Revolution Books New York City, and there's on the front page of that site, there's a link to get to the speech. That's our show for today. I want to thank all of my guests, law professor and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohn, Wells Dixon from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and political economist Raymond Latta. I also want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, Henry Carson, and Age for production assistance, and all of you for tuning in. Each week in this show, we start out with the understanding that the world cries out for radical change. There's a better way of life we could be and should be living, but it's up to us, each and every one of us, and what we do to get us there. And I hope that this show continues to be a part of this whole process. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com.
We're going to go out with another piece from Sonny Rollins and his Global Warming CD. This is Mother Nature's Blues. Thank you.